Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTDHD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. I am delighted to welcome back into our studios today for his monthly visit to the program, Dr. Art Sear. He is director of the Clausen Center at Carthage College and Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business, author of After the Cold War. His columns appear in newspapers across the country and internationally as well. And we are very, very grateful to Professor Sear for making time in his very busy schedule to join us once a month to talk about what usually turns out to be a plethora of different issues and concerns of both domestic and international concern. And so, Professor Sear, it's great to welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, Professor Berg, it's great to be here, and it's great to listen to your gracious introductions. You could go on and on and on.
Yeah, but we have a lot to talk about. And actually, before we get into some of the weightier matters at hand, just summarize for us how you spent the summer, because you strike me as a professor who typically does exceptionally interesting things in the summer. At least you don't end up sticking around in one place very much.
I was in, well, thank you. Every summer I try to catch up on substantive writing beyond these weekly columns. And writing, in fact, is very difficult for me. If I have a weekly deadline, I get the job done. More ambitious, in-depth, more academic things are obviously more challenging. And I'm feeling better than I have for several years at the end of the summer in terms of what I've actually been able to accomplish. College is increasingly involved in Asia for all kinds of reasons, including President Woodward's sustained initiative, he and his immediate staff and our faculty colleagues, to increase the college's involvement in China. We're supplementing and complementing that by taking steps to get more involved in other parts of Asia. And I spent several days in Tokyo on business, which was enjoyable, and I had not been to Japan for quite a while. I have been to Japan since 1979. It's a much more open environment in all kinds of ways, obvious and subtle, including the fact that there are more and more young people from outside of Japan, not only visiting but working in Japan and vice versa. Thanks to Yan Wang, our good colleague in modern languages, who teaches Japanese, who's from China, I was connected with Andrew Nimmer, a 2001 graduate of Carthage, who works for SoftSource, a tech internet-focused placement and recruiting firm that works throughout Asia. He's based in Tokyo. He's now married to a young woman who is Japanese, and they have a child. He, to me, personifies the fact that Japan, like other countries, including our own, is opening up in important and positive ways. I also met with longtime colleagues at the Japan, contacts and colleagues at the Japan External Trade Organization, JETRO, the external arm of METI, now METI, the Ministry of Economics, Trade, and Industry, this enormously powerful institution, in some ways comparable to our Pentagon. And the defense ministries in other countries since World War II, a lot of the very dedicated, disciplined professionals who might have joined the military at an earlier time have been devoting their time, fortunately for everyone, to economic expansion in and beyond Japan. JETRO is giving priority attention to recruiting interns, a priority of Carthage College for Japanese companies, and they're encouraging investment into Japan. The external trade offensive that began in the 1960s and continued for decades was very, very challenging for them. This, in many ways, is even more challenging, and it presents opportunities for fresh cooperation. But it was quite a tonic for me to be around Mr. Nimmer, who's older than a current undergraduate, but not by that much, and a good deal younger than I am. It was a good conversation.
Very good. And so it was interesting for you to see the way Japan has changed in some dramatic ways over the course of when you have visited there.
Yeah, it's overall a very positive development. Mm-hmm. They are, coincidentally, I was there not very long after Trump had talked about supplying nuclear weapons to Japan and South Korea, and that had become a kind of focus, understandably, of professionals, especially in the government, and I had to talk more about that subject than I would have preferred. But I hope I was reassuring about the realities of America. Mm-hmm. But we are certainly all to be reassured by the fact that it's a stable, increasingly open and transparent political as well as economic system. Mm-hmm. There's a lot long term that's very positive, and a direct Japanese people have accomplished this, but it's a direct compliment and testimony to the farsightedness and good sense, let me emphasize that, in this campaign year of American foreign policy, especially during the Roosevelt, Truman, and Eisenhower years.
By the way, how much do the Japanese dwell on the after effects of the devastating earthquake and tsunami, which happened not all that long ago? I mean, is their recovery from that emphatic enough that that's not sort of still resonating kind of in their kind of daily thoughts, if you know what I mean?
Well, like economically, it's kind of like Brexit. It doesn't, the same human tragedy isn't involved, but the British decision to leave the common market has generated ongoing media commentary, partly because that sells newspapers or draws eyes to websites in contemporary vernacular. The human tragedy was very, very significant in terms of loss of life and injury, but fears of long-term economic consequences seem to have been, again, not misplaced, but fortunately exaggerated. Mm. At the same time, frankly, there's been a great deal of difficulty and frustration and inefficiency in terms of making the nuclear reactor involved truly safe. And the reconstruction and dealing with that has been a source of frustration and embarrassment in the public sector, which seems to be very important. That's a topic that I didn't bring up and wasn't brought up, but it's a very good question, very perceptive. I think there's been a kind of subtle, important psychological impact. The economic and structural impact outside of the immediate area is seems to be minimal.
Mm-hmm. Well, while we're in that part of the world, we should talk about the most recent provocative gestures out of the nation of North Korea, which, of course, managed, as they were probably designed to generate some headlines and some concerns, both in the region and in points farther afield as well. You typically, in your reaction to these kind of acts of defiance from North Korea, are that they are just, it's the latest in a long series of sort of more of the same. Do the latest headlines out of North Korea speak to anything different, anything more ominous, or do you see this as just one more car in a long train of the same provocative acts for the same reason?
More the latter, I believe. But as I like to underscore from time to time on your good program, I'm an academic. I don't have classified information, and we academics, as you may have noticed, are very good at predicting the past. Definitely not the future. The ceasefire that Eisenhower was able to achieve remarkably quickly right after he was inaugurated as president in the spring of 1953 has held now for 6+ decades. That's the most important fact to keep in mind. For all the overblown, overheated rhetoric and occasional violence, including very pointed violence directed directly by Pyongyang against the South and against their own people and government officials, who seem to be increasingly subject to arbitrary, not only arrest, but murder. It really isn't execution, it's just plain murder at the whim of the ruler. These are disturbing trends. The North Korean regime has detonated, as you indicated, the largest nuclear warhead ever. They're getting better and better at that. They also have an erratic record of launching missiles, including sea-based missiles, but they're working better and better. There's no immediate threat to the United States. It's understandable that Japan, as well as South Korea, they're feeling nervous, and there is a very real threat of war. It is a tinderbox. It is a very tense border, literally, at the 38th parallel, where there is occasional violence. There's never been a peace treaty. What Eisenhower was able to achieve was an armistice, which has held the North Korean regime within the past couple of years, formally declared a state of war, abrogated the armistice. That's significant, but again, nothing in terms of general violence has happened. For that reason, we should be very conscious of war, and in terms of U.S. attitudes as well as foreign policy, we've been so removed from involvement of our general population in a general war, thank God, for so long that an increasing amount of the discussion in the media, to me at least, is conducted by people who are advertised as military experts but have not been in the military. Those who have are pretty much removed from combat in terms of what one can tell, especially in the more sensational media. A risk of war exists because North Korea may finally start shooting in a sustained way, but also we might miscalculate because people making decisions in this country are increasingly removed from war. In that regard, one specific event that I want to mention is the publication of a new book by one of our colleagues, Mark Miller, in the Management and Marketing Department. Our business colleagues in both that department and accounting and finance, and for that matter, other people in the faculty, but they tend to have a lot of business experience. He had a long and successful career with J.I. Case, the old J.I. Case Corporation, in Racine before coming to Carthage to teach, where he's been for over a decade. He's come out with a new book about his Vietnam experience as he served as an infantryman in the U.S. Army in Vietnam. Create Space, an independent publishing company, has just brought out his book. He was good enough to ask me to read through the manuscript, which I did. The title relates to his Vietnam Confessions. I recommend it strongly that he choose a different title, but it's his book. He actually quite grippingly describes what it's really like to be in military combat, and I would really commend that. The best way to educate yourself about what might happen in the future regarding possible wars is what's happened in the past. I don't minimize the importance of Iraq and Afghanistan, but those are very, very limited conflicts to a remarkable degree. They're not being discussed at all. Obama in 2008 did talk about Iraq and especially Afghanistan, but even that limited discussion seems to have faded from the public scene. Obviously, I feel strongly about this kind of thing.
Right. The point of concern in what you just described in terms of North Korea is when you talked about how they are getting better at this.
Yes.
That in terms of technology, they seem to be advancing. And that is in contrast to the way in which North Korea is sometimes characterized, rightly so, as completely isolated and economically desperate, and also often kind of a bumbler with more bombast than actual muscle with which to back it up, and it sounds like in at least one respect, North Korea is quietly becoming a more formidable, realistic threat than they once were. I mean, they once did a lot of yelling, did a lot of stamping of their feet, but could not, in a sense, have backed it up. And you seem to be indicating that one way or another, somehow they are advancing their own strength. Maybe not by a huge margin or anything, but
in terms of nuclear weapons capabilities, they have a very powerful conventional military. They've also been very active in mischief making in the international system since the Korean War. Any kind of black market activity, weapons, including supplying terrorists directly, counterfeit currency, bootleg liquor, prostitution, drugs, that any vice that one might mention, and I mean any vice, they're into it. And it is an important source of currency for the regime. At the same time, and that continues, and that is a real problem as opposed, I mean, an active danger as opposed to their using nuclear weapons. Secondly, our intelligence, one can be confident, is good regarding this kind of activity, but also the nuclear dimension. In 2010, in a brilliant airstrike, the Israeli Air Force took out, destroyed a nuclear facility in Syria, and the evidence after the strike was clear. The U.S. and Israel made it very, very public in the United Nations that North Korean scientists and technicians and other people from the government were working very, very closely with Syrians to develop nuclear weapons. That's undeniable. It was an extraordinarily impressive feat by Israeli forces and Israeli intelligence. We can be confident that U.S. intelligence was working closely with them. It was particularly daring, but also our record, from what I can tell from the outside, and no classified access, has been quite good. Closer to the scene, the South Korean army is quite capable of taking care of itself and handling any threat, especially with the backup of U.S. air power in terms of any conventional war in the Korean Peninsula.
Right. So we don't need to be too frightened, but it's certainly a point of concern that North Korea is managing somehow to advance its own strength. But
it's purely military. It's purely military. Economically, they're a shambles. Literally a wreck.
Right. And that is a crucial element in anybody being able to successfully wage a war.
Yeah. There was a party congress, and these communist party congresses are important for any power that remains a communist country. I believe the last one they had was in 1980. It was a long time ago. It was held earlier this year, around the middle of the year. Kim Jong-un appeared in a civilian suit, in a civilian attire, not his usual overdone melodramatic North Korean military uniform, and he talked very explicitly about the economic problems of the country, and that was the most important message to come from that. Beijing and China has the most important leverage over North Korea, far more than Russia. They both provide humanitarian aid to North Korea, and it's imperative that the U.S. continue to do everything we can to get Beijing to increase their leverage on the North. They're very unhappy about nuclear weapons and have denounced them.
Right. Let's move to a nation you mentioned in passing, Syria, and the fragile ceasefire brokered there primarily by U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov.
Right.
This remains, of course, a truly desperate situation for the ordinary citizens of Syria, unfortunate enough to remain in that country. It's just hard to imagine a more terrible scenario. What is your sense of this latest ceasefire? It sounds like you are impressed by those who worked so, especially Secretary Kerry, who worked so hard to broker it.
Yeah, well, Kerry is, as I mentioned before in your program and in print, his energy level and dedication to the job is absolutely phenomenal, especially since he isn't so young anymore, and so for me he's quite inspiring. But quite beyond that, he does get the job done. I think he might well emerge as one of our really, if he makes it, to my mind, four great secretaries of state since World War II. the climate change executive agreement that President Obama reached with President Xi of China directly reflects Kerry's hard work. I believe there's good circumstantial evidence he worked very successfully with Lavrov and others to implement Putin's commitment to actually get Syria to abandon CBR, chemical, biological, and radiological weapons, which succeeded after the U.S. Kind of fumbled the ball. Those are only two examples. He has been an extremely effective Secretary of State. Now, mind you, there was a ceasefire that was achieved in February in the same place, on about the same terms, and by May that had unraveled. The Russians are notorious for being very cold-blooded and ruthless in their conduct of foreign policy in particular. And they signed the ceasefire agreement. They used it as an opportunity to strengthen the Assad regime. So be it. I think the dynamics now are more in favor, partly because of the horrific civilian as well as military costs that are being paid by the combatants and the innocent bystanders. I think this one has a better chance of holding longer. It's better than continuing the fighting. It just went into effect on Monday, and we'll see. But the fact that we could reach an agreement at all is encouraging.
Hmm. When I read your column about that, one word that leapt out at me was ironically. I mean, that always means, you know, something unexpected is being pointed out, and you wrote, the collaboration, ironically, is a result of the forceful direct military intervention in Syria of the Russian military 1 year ago.
Yeah, stabilize the situation. Too much of our commentary, as usual with good old Americans, we confuse practical benefit and a desirable diplomatic stability with the moral value and defensibility of a particular partner. In a world which still largely does not have the rule of law, leaders who can be congruent with American interests, even if they're undesirable characters, are important to work with. That's reality. That's not cynicism. And too often Americans, more than other people, tend to put a moral imperative on decision-making. Hmm. Putin, I'm not defending him. He's a very undesirable character personally. He is a KGB killer who made his bones in the utterly totalitarian regime of East Germany, the German Democratic Republic, during the Cold War. I'm not defending him or his methods, but at the moment, what Russia is pursuing is leading to a situation that is more stable, and it's congruent with American interests. I believe that, quite apart from Russia, we have consistently underestimated Assad's staying power and the effectiveness of that regime. Again, not to be defended in any moral or ethical sense, but the effectiveness of that regime in staying in power. His dad consolidated his power in 1970, and in effect, the family has been in power ever since. I think insofar as they're opposed to ISIS, and insofar as the regime's position geopolitically is congruent with American interests, we should be willing to work with them, mm-hmm. at least indirectly.
Right.
That's not a popular view, and I want to emphasize the fact again, I'm not speaking about the moral worth or value of any particular people or regime.
You're speaking from a point of view of practicality.
Well, American interests and right. what's likely to lead to stability over the long run, and the fact that our highest interest must be the destruction of this quite insane and quite suicidal ISIS movement, which does seem to be weakening, reflected in part by their own overblown rhetoric, which is becoming more and more extreme. Hmm. Insofar as one can tell, in the field, allied forces are gaining ground, and that's all to the good, and that has to be our primary focus. Again, it's not a John Wayne movie. They're not good people and bad people in some kind of simplistic confrontation. I hope this is a clear point, because it's contrary to what one hears in all contexts, including, of course, our academic context.
Right. I believe it was since your last visit to the program that you wrote about the attempted and ultimately unsuccessful military coup attempt in Turkey, which, of course, ratcheted up tension in the region and was a tense situation for us as well, since Turkey is important to the United States and a very, very crucial player in that part of the world. I wanted to ask you specifically about something you mentioned in passing in that column, which was the fact that social media played, you say, a significant role in undermining that coup attempt. Can you just kind of spell out in what way social media was a significant player in something like that?
Yes, the officers who tried to take over made their move when President Erdogan was out of the capital, in the country, and apparently rather isolated. Unfortunately for them, fortunately for the regime, they didn't grab him first, but he had access to his cell phone, and he made a rather dramatic video appeal via his cell phone, not some large, elaborate, old-time television studio, to the people of Turkey. They went into the streets. The army, their jets were making symbolic low overflights in Ankara and Istanbul. Troops had taken major transportation hubs and bridges. But Turks poured out into the streets, and the military, fortunately, was not willing to fire on large numbers of the fellow citizens, and they gave up. It was obviously not your well-planned, thoroughgoing military coup, which Turkey has experienced in the past. Under the Constitution, the military was formerly the guardian of the country, and there was a tradition of military intervention.
Mm. Before we get to the matter of Mr. Trump and Mrs. Clinton and this ferociously waged presidential campaign, I want to give you a moment to talk about a really interesting insight you shared about Brexit, which, of course, is shorthand for Britain's exit from the European Union. And you chose to write about one facet of that you think is largely overlooked, and I agree. I mean, until I read your column, I don't remember anywhere seeing much in the way of serious acknowledgement of the defensive and military and intelligence sort of ramifications of Britain's withdrawal from the EU. What are some of the most important ways in which this could be a significant consequence of their withdrawal? What kinds of things does Britain lose by withdrawing from the EU when it comes to this?
I don't think they lose much. Those several former intelligence officials, heads of MI5 and MI6, their domestic and overseas intelligence operations, came out publicly against leaving the Union because there was the potential of losing intelligence information shared through the EU. However, Britain remains a very active and very influential member of NATO. These acronyms get a little confusing. Theresa May, the new prime minister, was Home Secretary, a very influential and very durable Home Secretary, and she was very explicit in making the same point. At the same time, there is very active and traditional and very thorough intelligence sharing, from what one can tell, among the Five Eyes, the U.S., Britain, as well as Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, dating from the crucial and vital days of the Second World War and highest stakes days of that war. That will continue, and in practical terms, institutional collaboration may well be increased. Intelligence channels may become closer across the Atlantic. Challenges might also increase, too. One of the most significant and sensitive areas for the British and the British Isles generally is Northern Ireland. the border is now open between Northern Ireland and the South. There is open commerce. Ireland remains a member of the European Union. Northern Ireland is part of the United Kingdom. There was long-time sectarian violence that did not become enormous, but was very brutal and sustained from about 1969-70 until the comprehensive agreement that the British were able to broker at the end of the century. Feelings remain very, very hard, and the situation remains tense. British intelligence was crucial in stabilizing the situation, because with their usual thoroughness, they got very detailed information on the most influential leaders of the active, violent wing of the IRA. And they worked closely with the Unionists, frankly, this is not classified information, to kill them. There was a series of very, very systematic killings which effectively removed the leadership of the IRA. That was the background, but the IRA has not disappeared, and it was crucial to brokering an agreement, but obviously warm-hearted brotherhood and fraternity have not emerged. There is the potential, with Britain and Ireland no longer in the EU together, for pretty cruel violence to reemerge. It also testifies to the significance of British intelligence. There's a reason why James Bond is so popular, and why that... why it's evolved the way it has. Fascinating history. Ian Fleming, in fact, was a very important British intelligence official during World War II, the creator of Mr. Bond, right. Who was a close associate of Alan Dulles, head of U.S. intelligence in Switzerland.
Right.
Could make a good movie.
Absolutely.
Maybe it has.
Maybe you're a
could
movie
be
or
it will.
Right.
Yeah.
But yeah, James Bond is not from Wisconsin. It speaks to this long legacy of impressive work in intelligence.
Exactly.
And I think you feel like there are ways in which the United States still has a lot to learn.
There are a lot of reasons why the U.S. escalated the Vietnam War in 1965 with direct heavy combat involvement on the ground and in the air over the North. Indonesia, which is now a very close ally of the U.S. and an anti-terrorism stalwart with the largest Islamic population in the world. Indonesia in the mid-60s was increasingly close to the Soviet Union, including increasingly intimate joint naval exercises and operations. A left-wing regime, which was an understandable worry for U.S. foreign policy leaders, including spanning world trade routes, as it still does. They invaded Malaysia. British military and intelligence forces, with quite a small force, was able to blunt and defeat and frustrate a much more substantial Indonesian military operation. It is a large military. I don't want to go on at excessive length, but they demonstrate this again and again and again. The Americans are much more inclined to send in lots of forces, lots of firepower, and related to my earlier point, in my biased view, we tend to romanticize unconventional conflict at the same time. The dynamics of Vietnam with 20/20 hindsight were quite different. With Green Berets and special forces of the sort the Kennedy brothers loved, we could not have stopped the revolution in Vietnam in hindsight. But British effectiveness is extremely important in terms of providing a realistic perspective to us. McGeorge Bundy, Kennedy's national security advisor from that earlier time, liked to say that the British provide someone to talk to. They're someone for us. They're really a great guide, and he was right. And they absolutely refused, despite the Johnson administration's entry, they absolutely refused to send any troops to South Vietnam.
Well, we have a few minutes left, and probably not enough time to really thoroughly talk about what the presidential campaign has meant thus far. I mean, we've certainly touched on it in your previous visits.
It's okay, Greg. Others are talking constantly.
No kidding. I should think that when it comes to some of the positions that Donald Trump has taken, I should think that towards the very top of the list of things that are a source of concern for you are some of the statements that he has made about NATO and what our role should be with NATO, and the insufficiency of some of our NATO partners in terms of pulling their fair share, and so on. Is he raising a legitimate question there, or not?
Sure, it's a legitimate question, especially because NATO is so durable. But I do think the NATO alliance, well, it survived the Cold War. It was set up to oppose the Soviet Union and their satellites, and they're gone, and NATO still exists. I think NATO will survive American presidential politics. I'd like to make a somewhat different point, not just because I'm fortunate to be where I am in academia. I am particularly disheartened by the lack of any serious policy discussion. I'm just an academic. I'm not a political pro. I believe the Clinton people are making a major mistake in this constant, relentless emphasis on Trump's personality and his shortcomings. They're constantly doing what they're accusing him of doing and what he's rightly accused of. Naturally, we want a higher-level policy discussion. But I think it can boomerang, perhaps dramatically, I don't know, on Election Day to his benefit. When I was in Japan watching CNN, lying in bed in my hotel room at night, a particularly arrogant young CNN type, from my point of view, said, why are they supporting him? This is a correspondent, not an editorialist. The market's doing fine. Unemployment is going down. Well, I'll tell you something. 50% of Americans are now in the stock market through retirement funds. That's great. But Donald Trump voters are, to a significant degree, people who don't invest actively and proactively in the stock market. They are people who believe mom and dad, and even more grandma and grandpa from the Great Depression, who said, stay away from those city slickers and thieves in the stock market. Put your money in a savings account where you'll earn solid interest. Put your money in U.S. savings bonds and U.S. savings stamps. The listeners already know, if you're putting all your money in a standard, reliable, federally insured savings, you're making nothing. Our world has changed so dramatically and so disturbingly for many people, including particular populations that have a high unemployment rate and have been thrown out of work quite dramatically, thrown out of the factory floor where grandpa and even dad spent 30 or 40 years with a good union job. They're upset. And the fact that it's not as profound as the segregation from our military and the realities of war, but the fact that we have a professional media class that is totally separate, it's just feeding Trump. It's just feeding this hostility. And I think it's a big mistake to constantly patronize these people and constantly insult him in the way that he insults others. He's succeeded in dragging down the level of debate very significantly.
Right.
I hope I don't sound too carried away. I got carried away in an earlier program of yours talking about him and how much his candidacy upsets me, which was a mistake on my part.
Right. I'm not sure about that, but at any rate, what you just said brings to mind a really interesting article that was in the New York Times, I believe this past Sunday, and it basically spoke to the desperation of certain Americans, a sense of desperation, and again, it is people who are doing without. Several of the people who were that the article quoted were people who maybe live in the Rust Belt or who live in the most impoverished pockets of Appalachia or so on, and they feel a sense of hope with Mr. Trump and what he offers that they don't get from anybody else, and even knowing his personal shortcomings, his lack of experience, and so on.
And also his cynicism. I don't want to go off on it, but you don't have to study much about his career or deal much with the detail. He's a cynical con man on a grand scale.
And yet he is speaking to many people in that population.
Exactly.
And I think what you're saying is if you were in a position to advise Mrs. Clinton and or her campaign advisors, you would be telling them that they need to continue to try to offer some kind of tangible word of hope to these very people who at the moment are turning to Mr. Trump.
I don't want to be glib or make light. I first became aware of him when I was running the World Trade Center organization in Chicago. I'm very proud of what we accomplished working together and getting them out of a lot of financial difficulty. and stress without firing anyone. Gary, Indiana, the city government, interestingly enough, proved to be a vital source of support early on. I never missed a payroll. Contract support from Gary was crucial, and I first became aware of him because he was first prospecting to open the casinos there. And the more I learned about him, I thought of the old musical, The Music Man, a very durable classic from an earlier period. Right. And at the end of the story, The Music Man is redeemed, in his case, by a fine woman who saves him from himself, and maybe something like that can happen, at least at a metaphorical level.
So you're thinking, you think Donald Trump is another Harold Hill, in a sense.
Yeah, of course, Harold Hill lost in the end, and con men do.
Right.
Play it straight, you do better over the long term. We all know that.
Interesting.
Or should.
Right. Well, it will be interesting to see if the tenor of this campaign changes at all, and particularly as we approach the debates, to see what in the way of policy substance begins to dominate the proceedings.
Quite right.
There is the perception by some that Mr. Trump is carrying himself in a little more serious fashion, not spewing quite so many outrageous, intentionally provocative statements as before. Is that your sense, too?
Maybe he really does want to be president. Hmm. But you're right. He must be driving his handlers crazy.
Right.
It's a whiff of that comes out in the media. But he is, to say the least, unpredictable.
Right. What is your guess about Mrs. Clinton's health setback, this case of pneumonia that has actually kept her off the campaign trail for several days now? Do you see that? Would you expect that to be a significant point of concern for her, or is that dwarfed by some of the other concerns you raised earlier?
I don't. It depends. Again, I predict the past, my friend. It depends on whether she stumbles again and how badly. But really rich, enormously funded campaigns, more and more populated by enormously driven, ambitious people with their own big egos, they tend to become muscle bound. And the remarkably clumsy way in which this was handled by our staff, I think, is an indicator of that. Hmm. Money is not, it's essential, but money is double-edged in politics. And just because you're enormously wealthy and have name recognition, a big organization, that doesn't mean you make it. It really doesn't.
Hmm. Well, let's end on a little more positive note.
Thank you.
You wanted to make mention of some of the very ambitious plans of a politician much closer to home, namely the newly elected mayor of Kenosha, John Antaramian, and I should say newly reelected. He was mayor for a time and then stepped away, and with the retirement of Keith Bosman, Mr. Antaramian successfully won reelection to reassume the office of mayor. And you have taken note of some of his plans that you think are impressive.
Well, they're hard to miss in a positive sense. He's been getting great coverage in the Kenosha News and serious coverage on this station. He has proposed a very ambitious infrastructure project, including new investment, especially in neglected brownfield portions of Kenosha, transportation investment, and transportation infrastructure at our Clawson Center. And he was good enough to do some teaching at Carthage College in the political science department in between his stints as mayor, and did a very fine job. He brought a real-world perspective and some great visitors to campus. Bruce Rauner, the governor, very visible governor of Illinois, has been devoting substantial amounts of his own money to political candidates, Republican, of course, in Illinois, but he's also been devoting funds to selected Republicans in Indiana, where the vice presidential Republican nominee is based. He was on the news this morning. I listened to it driving up on another station, I confess. The emphasis he gave to transportation and new investment and the regional nature of our transportation infrastructure was, he may or may not succeed ultimately as governor, but he's a very, very successful, insightful business entrepreneur and has a lot of his own money to spend. That reinforced to me that Mayor Antaramian here in Kenosha is really involving us in a much wider network. Mm. Public transportation is an important, including buses, is an important part of his comprehensive plan. It's impressive that he's got such a detailed plan and that he started to implement it so quickly after taking office.
Right. And maybe the fact that he ably served in the state legislature before becoming mayor maybe helps him see some of these questions, not just in the narrow perspective of this city and its borders, but sees it in the context of the region in a way that someone who has only been a mayor might not be as inclined to see.
And related to our earlier discussion, a political leader who plays it straight and is known thereby, and that's all to the good over the longer term.
Mm. Well, on that note, we have to finish out this conversation, but Professor Art Sear, I certainly hope that the month of October will allow you to join us one last time, maybe for one last comment about Mr. Clinton and Mrs. Clinton and Mr. Trump.
Mr. Clinton's involved too, apparently.
Absolutely. And all the other points of concern that we want to be talking
Mrs.
about.
And Mrs. Trump, don't forget.
Right, absolutely, absolutely. We'll talk about all of them and more the next time you join us. Dr. Art Sear from Carthage College, thank you so much for today's conversation.
Thank you, sir.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, something very, very different and exciting in a different way. We're going to be having six professional cartoonists joining us who are all in town for the most recent Kenosha Festival of Cartooning. And so we will have with us an animator from the television series Phineas and Ferb. We will have the artist in responsible for the wonderful comic strip Non Sequitur. Actually, one of the cartoonists who will join us is John Hambrock from Kenosha with the wonderful strip The Brilliant Mind of Edison Lee, and several others involved in various aspects of the marvelous world of cartooning. So that is tomorrow's morning show. I hope you'll make a special point of joining us for that. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived at WGTD.org. Support for The Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed